People sometimes inquire whether enlightenment or liberation or fulfillment in the religious sense comes suddenly or gradually through effort, practice, through time. The actual realization or enlightenment is a momentary thing, comes in a flash. But it comes because there has been a gathering momentum towards that fruition through a period of time. Occasionally, something suddenly comes out of the blue in our lives. And we say that was the beginning, not the climax of long effort through the past. But I believe that if we are able to investigate all the factors at play in such a situation, we will find that there were so many things unbeknown to the person which took place, made their contribution, and then, in the ripeness of circumstance, in which the individual himself and his whole environment were just in the perfect relationship to each other, the precipitation into the realization takes place. The within has to meet the without in a state of perfection. The effort of the within oneself, can be defeated by circumstance time and again. Or the favorable circumstance might not find a proper response, an urge, an outgoing from within. So nothing happens. But in that magical moment, when the two are in real harmony, lo and behold, the enlightenment takes place. Both elements, the within and the without, have played their part and continuously play their part. And this is one of the very important things we must bear in mind always, that where religious fulfillment is concerned, there is no such thing as coming to an end in terms of enlightenment, fulfillment, liberation, or whatever you like. The enlightened state, the liberated state, the perfection which one is looking for, is of the nature of life. Take our own physical body. The heart beats from the moment, from before we are born, till we are dead. The blood streams through the body all the time. Nothing stops working. Everything goes on. In those marvelous states when one is absolutely, feeling absolutely fine, there is a peak point of cooperation and efficiency in every part of the body working in perfect coordination. Isn't that? So too with fulfillment and liberation. It's not like a school course or a university career where finally you take an examination, obtain your degree, and that's finished. You've come to a dead end. Or, if you like, one's career in a business or wherever it is, you climb the ladder, as we call it, step by step, reach the top. And there is a top in all these other circumstances and situations. Because these circumstances and situations are completely confined to the sphere of the limited, the particular, the finite, something which begins, proceeds, and ends, belongs to the sphere of the mortal. But where the religious life is concerned, we are in the sphere of the immortal, the non-particular, the unlimited, the infinite. There is no measurement here. There is in actual fact no beginning or ending, no movement in terms of beginning or ending, as we understand beginning and ending in finite terms, in space and time. But there is a movement, if you like, that is to say an activity, which goes on in that inner life, all of its own nature, which escapes perception or analysis by the brain, by our sense-mind activity. Because this transcends the activity of sense and mind. So, the everlastingness, the continuity, if you like, it's a difficult word to use in this context, but we'll use it. The continuity of the state of perfection, of holiness, of fulfillment, of enlightenment, of liberation. The continuity of it is not a measurable continuity. It is of a nature where you cannot follow the steps. But it is, in its extraordinary isness, it contains time and all the limitations of time. In its extraordinary isness, its essential timelessness and immortality is embodied and manifested in terms of the movement through time and limited manifestation. See, this holiness literally means the unbroken holiness of reality, of totality. An unbroken holiness. But when it manifests in the outer world which we experience, it manifests only through the individual, the separate individual, who has become unresisting, completely sensitive, a perfect channel for this manifestation to take place. So now, naturally we ask the question, then this implies that we must make a continuous effort. Effort not in the sense of resisting or opposing anything whatsoever. Our common conception of effort and the good life is the usual come in a garden, fight the good fight, resist the evil with all your might and all the rest of it. Not that way. Whatever evil I resist is strengthened by my resistance. The evil I am resisting is in my own self. It is part and parcel of my psychical being. And if I wrestle with it and struggle with it, it will also get strong. We all know two lads get together, good friends. They say, "Let's have a wrestle." They are wrestling out of friendship. But in that struggling with each other, the one strengthens the other. The muscles of both of them get stronger and stronger. That is how it is with our psychical being. So it is an effort which is not a resistance. It is not a contradiction to something which we call good within ourselves. This is one of the difficult things to appreciate in this whole process. We are constantly resisting what we call evil. Now, consider carefully another aspect of this. If we resist something, it is because we believe that if that were out of the way, something more desirable would take its place. But in all such situations, my standards and criteria are worldly standards and criteria. I can very easily fool myself that they are spiritual, that they are pure. They are not. Every single one of those standards of judgment, my criteria, my yardsticks for measurement, are all related to myself. They are self-oriented. And in finality, all that happens is that this self-enclosingness from which we all suffer becomes greater than ever. Put it in other terms, we are lonelier than ever. And we fail to realize the true aloneness, the true individuality, in which we are not only a harmony within, but are completely related to everything without, free of any dependence upon the without. Then you are the true individual, the undivided from the whole. You are independent, but completely related. You stand on your own feet. Whereas all worldly criteria and standards according to which we act, think, and direct our efforts, all of them are self-oriented. Now, can we put our finger upon the very root of all this? You remember last time we started with quite a short meditation in which we saw that this organism which goes by our name in the world is what we refer to as I and every other similar organism in the world, and there are 3,500 millions of them, we refer to as you. And every single you is similarly oriented towards all the others. 3,500 million people through the world refer to themselves as I, and the remaining 3,500 million as you. One would think that by that token there ought to be 3,500 million squared yous in the world, and only 3,500 million I's. In actual fact, there are only 3,500 million people. There is neither addition nor multiplication applying in this sphere. But if you are you for me, and I am you for you, you see, what is the relationship between this I and this you? What is its essential meaning? Because we are conscious in this separative way, this isolative way, where you are the other, the non-being, the not-self, and I am the self, because of this isolative consciousness, do we not break up the unity of the one total reality? This sundering of the unity in our consciousness is the fundamental meaning and fact of the word sin. When Roman Catholicism declares that we are all born in sin, this is a real meaning of that statement. It has nothing to do with the way the physical body is procreated. That is all nonsense. That is just nature's way. And since the Lord God himself was responsible for nature's way, well, if you want to put any blame, put it on the Lord God, not upon the individual. He is the great sinner. If that is the absurd meaning of the word sin. But the word sin literally means to try to sunder the unity. That is sin. Whatsoever sunders the unity is sin. And the unity, remember, between innumerable unique particulars is in terms of relationship. It is the relationship that makes the unity. Otherwise, we just have a characterless uniformity all the way through. You see? But everything is individual and unique. But its real individuality consists not in its apparent separateness, but in the fact that it is harmoniously related to the totality. Now, this isolative self-consciousness is the villain of the piece. Now there's another point to consider. Each one of us as an individual is not to blame for this. We can't help it. We are born in ignorance. We don't know. We haven't got the faculties to perceive and be responsive to all the relationships that actually exist between all persons and all things throughout the universe. We just haven't got that capacity, that faculty. We begin to see it when we read about it, or somebody talks about it, and so forth. That is the first intimation we get about it. Sometimes intimations come without talking or reading. Perhaps all of you have at some time or other, especially in childhood, suddenly wondering, who am I really? What is all this? In that state, if there was, by great good fortune, an inner quietness at that time, you may have suddenly felt, oh, but everything is I. The child will only think in those terms, I, won't think in terms of you. Everything is I, everything is myself. I am the flower, I am the sky. You know how we ambitiously, egoistically want to become as tall as the sky. I did anyway. And so forth. So that is a possibility. And that may happen not merely in childhood, it may happen later on in life. And you're suddenly overwhelmed with this sense of the one total reality. And that one total reality is you yourself. The flaw here is that one still thinks of oneself as a specific self in the midst of the unity. So one slips back to ordinary, isolative self-consciousness. Now, self-consciousness is not the trouble. As such, self-consciousness as such is not the trouble. We have to be self-conscious, otherwise we couldn't even cross the street in safety. We have to be conscious in the separatist way in order to be aware that there are vehicles, there are other people, there are trees, there are walls. Otherwise we couldn't move about at all. But when that self-consciousness takes the next step of being constantly concerned with itself and isolating itself from everything else, and not waking up to the fact of the relationships that exist, then this isolative self-consciousness lies at the root of all pain, sorrow, difficulty, misery, problems, and so on. What is the meaning of the word problem? The relationships are not understood. A problem is there because one doesn't see, one doesn't understand. And what is the supreme problem we have through our lives? Our own self. Do we understand ourselves? Do we really see ourselves as we are in actual fact? Or do we have just an image of ourselves? So now, as and when we begin to be really attentive, watchful, in the right way, completely alert, but quiet, passive, neither indulging nor fighting against whatsoever comes up in the mind. When we begin to do that, we may begin to awake to the relationships between this which we call ourself and all the rest which we dump under the one word, not self. Some of these relationships we become aware of in clear analytical terms. But the total, the whole relationship is something which we sense. It's a sense. It's an awareness as distinct from consciousness. Consciousness as such implies I, the subject, observing you of the or that the object. There is a separation between the two. And consciousness functions mostly in analytical terms, the analyzed parts being immediately synthesized in order to get the wholeness of the pattern. But awareness is something which you can't analyze. It is like a touch sense as compared with a sight sense. Consciousness sees. Awareness touches. So when we approach this problem of our isolative self-consciousness, let the awareness of totality grow. There is nothing to do positively, as we say in the ordinary sense. A particular course of action. No. Just be watchful, alert, and quiet inside, as quiet as possible. Things come every day in our life to upset the quietness. We all know that. Watch the upset state. Don't fight against it. Just watch it, observe it. Because in that observing, there is a learning. And forces are released within our own psychical being which perform the task of healing. Just as the physical body, if wounded, has a tendency to heal itself. We don't know what the body does, but the body does it. It heals itself. The psyche heals itself if you let it alone. And in the case of the psyche, it performs the task of healing completely, which the body doesn't do. If the body is sufficiently wounded, it will perish. The whole organism will die. True enough. But with the psyche, it's different. You can thrust any number of swords through the psyche, or throw any number of atom bombs at it. You can't destroy it. It is there, always. It is insubstantial. That is the extraordinary thing about it. But it will heal. If you let it heal. Now here we have perhaps the key. For approaching all our problems. See, we want all our problems, our difficulties in the office, our matrimonial problems, our business problems, whatever they are, we want to solve them. What will we accept as the solution? If a shape, a pattern of things which I like comes into being, I'll say, oh, the problem is solved. Any pattern of things which I like, whatsoever it may be, and vice and the other way around, any pattern of things which I dislike, both of them contain the seeds of death in them. And they contain the seeds of disharmony in them. Because with the disappearance of what I like, I am miserable. See, this is something which we think we understand. We say, oh, I'm a Vedantist, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Christian, I've been taught to submit to the will of the Lord God, I'm a Muslim. The word Muslim means complete submission to the will of God. That's what the word means, you see. Well, collect all the Christians and Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims and so on all over the world and just see precisely how far they are. To what extent they have given themselves to the totality in this sense. Not a bit of it. O Lord God, I am thy slave, but please let me have everything the way I like it. This is human nature. Or rather, more accurately, subhuman nature. And this is what we are. We really must recognize this. We imagine that, oh yes, I understand this and I try to act accordingly. We don't. This isolative self-consciousness is so powerful. It so permeates our entire being. It's in every single one of the 15 million cells that makes up the body. That really to see and let the light penetrate this tremendous fog, or more than that, this solid opacity, which is the body, you see, is a titanic task. I can't carry out the titanic task as an I determined to achieve. Quite impossible. Recall that marvelous myth, Hercules and the Augean stables. No one can clean out the Augean stables. They are so vast and so filthy. And the filth is like cast iron. What did Heracles do? He just turned the stream, the river of life, of pure life. He didn't struggle against the thing. He just let life. And the stables were cleaned out. That's a tremendous lesson for us. But look, it took the man God. Hercules was the son of Zeus himself, the lord of Olympus, and Alcmene, a mortal. It took this extraordinary creature born of the immortal and the mortal to do it. What does it mean for us? If within each one of us a sense of transcendence has really begun to emerge, then that sense of transcendence is the Father here. Zeus, the Lord of Olympus, and our own psyche is the human female, Alcmene. And of the two, in activity within us, there emerges Heracles. Alcmene belongs to the realm of the limited, the particular, the mortal realm. Zeus belongs to the realm of the immortal. You see how the two blend to produce that new something in our own being which will effect the task, which will carry out the task. might be useful perhaps at this point just to spend a few minutes. Every day in our lives, situations arise in which we inevitably do the wrong thing because of isolative self-consciousness. Now, supposing we spend just 5 or 6 minutes recalling some particular situation during this last week in which we were caught napping, so to say, in which isolative self-consciousness was at work and spoilt the situation. We made a mistake or a series of mistakes. Just try and recall some situation like that. Look at it very, very calmly and quietly, but see it very clearly, very clearly. Some situation in which we lost our temper or got frightened or were overcome with anxiety or annoyance or positive jealousy or hate or envy or whatever it was. Now, just let's spend 5 or 6 minutes and see isolative self-consciousness at work. Try and see it very calmly, without regrets and that sort of thing. also as we observe any details which are responsible for disharmony, for trouble and so forth, be free of any determination to avoid that in future. Not a fixed determination that causes a blockage in the psyche. Just see the fact, really see it as such. If we pay attention intensely, but passively, just observing the fact quietly, then we'll be free of conflict inside, which is the really important thing. Free of inner conflict. Don't attempt to find reasons or give explanations inside one's own mind. Don't conduct a court case for or against the plaintiff or defendant or whatever it is. Just look quietly, that's all. No condemnations. See that at the root of it all, there is this isolative self-consciousness. Stop. If we really perceive the activity of this isolative self-consciousness, we will really understand that everything that is manifested is impermanent. We say intellectually, because we accept it in a sort of a logical way, that yes, whatever we see, it will perish someday, sometime, and so forth. But having said that, we remain unaffected by it. Which means it hasn't gone deep. It has only scratched the surface layer of the brain cells and nothing else. But if it is not purely a brain knowledge, merely a brain knowledge, but something which you are completely aware of, aware. Your whole sensitivity has seen that and responded to it. Then we shall be free of grasping at anything and everything. We shall be free of wanting to possess anything, to hold on to it, like holding on to life, like grim death. And that's exactly what people do. You see? Consider the freedom within. Now, this does not mean that one will become indifferent to persons or things, or one's duties, or procedures, or techniques, or whatever they are. One doesn't become indifferent to them at all. But because one has that inner freedom through non-grasping and that sensitivity, which is the result of being free of isolative self-consciousness, your whole life energy will go easily and sweetly into whatsoever task has to be performed. And what's more, one is intelligent enough to see what is one's proper task and what is one's proper business at the moment. And one minds one's own business and does not meddle with other people's affairs and so forth. Aren't we all awful meddlers in everybody else's business all along the line? And we find wonderful excuses for it. The most powerful example of that is parents towards child. Ah, but it's my child. I must do this, that and the other for the child's sake. I'm assuming that I know in the first instance just what I should do for the child. If indeed I do know that, I'm a super genius. It's an extraordinary conceit. It is really a lack of love which makes a parent do that. If he really loved the child, he would be so aware of the fact that he himself knows next to nothing. He will be so aware of that fact that he will have a better chance of letting the child grow peacefully and happily. Psychology in this century has begun to find out in some very considerable measure just how the parent spoils the life of the child. We trace when we go when we go to an analyst or something, somebody like that, and he asks questions, and you trace back the history of the present malaise to childhood conditions, the influence of the parents, and so on. We do that. Now, this is true, that such and such influences did play their part. What do we do next, if we are wise? Do we who suffer from the malaise which is attributed to our parents either sort of try to forgive in lordly fashion what the parent did, or to forget all about it? That sort of forgiving and forgetting, both of them are mistakes. you cannot forget. The conscious mind has the power to shut its eyes, just like the body has the power to shut its eyes. The unconscious mind cannot shut its eyes. It cannot not see, cannot forget. It is there. If I have a peptic ulcer, I may pretend it is not there. The jolly old peptic ulcer will carry on merrily giving me pain constantly. I can't pretend that way. You can't play ostrich with life. Bury your head in the sand and present the difficulty is not there. So forgetting is an absurdity. One has to be mindful to remember. And remember without wanting the shape of that thing to be altered into another shape which is pleasant to me. Then understanding grows. Then the real psychological healing takes place. Because if I observe the thing quietly, not giving way to my isolated self-consciousness at work, I completely absorb the whole situation, the whole trouble, and this applies to the opposite of trouble, the pleasant things too. I absorb the whole of it, and in that absorption is the transmutation of the trouble. And that is the complete healing, the real healing. Because you've got at its very root my own isolated self-consciousness. Then there is love in operation, which has nothing to do with sentiment or emotion or any sort of possessive relationship. Love, as we know it in the world today, is one of the most powerful forces, not altogether, but a good part of it is one of the most powerful forces for hurting, for distorting the beauty of life. We call it love. This thing of attachment, this thing of claws and tentacles, which wants to possess for the self. It is conditional. It is reciprocal. It lays down its laws. I will love, honor, and cooperate or obey you, provided you love and honor or cooperate with me in the manner which I consider is loving, honoring, cooperating. Don't forget that. This is the isolative self-consciousness at work. This is our fundamental ignorance at work. And so all the grasping, all the resentment when it is not fulfilled, all the ill will, malice, jealousy, anger, hate, everything comes up in this complex. And its root is this isolative self-consciousness. I am I, and you are you. And we'll make a bargain about living together. Quite impossible. The unity of the one total reality is an absolute fact. I can't improve it, I can't spoil it. As far as the fact is concerned, in the act of resisting it, through the misfortune of being ignorant of it, I will suffer and get ill and produce suffering outside me. But when I begin to see it as such, and remain quiet and not fight against my own difficulties inside, then this isolative self-consciousness changes, and you become aware of constant relationship. You become aware of wonderful things which are the reality between man and man, between man and things. Another thing we cease to grasp, another thing we drop, all ideals . The ideal is the desired thing. But when my ideal and your ideal clashes, then what? Where are we? I've had 25 experience in this situation, my dear sir. Who are you to tell me how it should be done? You don't know about it. The other fellow says to me, you fool, I've had 35 years experience at it. And I know better than you, because I've had 35 years experience at it. But 35 years of grinding the wrong way around will not produce the right result. If a person insists upon trying to play a piano with his nose, he'll only get a nose ache. He won't make music. Isn't that so? Forget all the words and the thoughts that come out as I speak. Get the feel of the thing. Let it be like a tremendous energy. Heracles, a stream of life, if you like. You see? And let it do its own task in its own way. Forget my words and thoughts, because they are limited, finite things. They are impermanent. But in the act of making the sound, the words, because you know the language and you know the meanings of the words attached, let in your own mind not another thought arise, but a power be released. This is the thing. You see, otherwise, any first-class brain can produce a wonderful pattern of thought which can be conveyed to another person or persons, a whole country, and they can all get the thought and they say, now the millennium will be established. It doesn't get established. Life isn't like that. The nature of life in its insideness is something which the brain does not know. And cannot know. Don't forget that. Truth, reality, the ultimate things, transcendence, is the unknown and unknowable. The knowable and knowability belong to the realm of structure only. A structure without function is a dead, useless thing. It's a fossil. Function is this something which is life. And only when the mind is free of slavery to the outward form, the thoughts, the philosophies, the ideas, the words, and so forth, when it is free of that, the limitation of those things, I mean, you see, then this living thing begins to work by itself. What keeps the body going? My knowledge of it? Not a bit of it. I don't know at all how the thing functions. I may study anatomy and physiology to the nth degree and know all about it, but I don't know how the works go. But they go. Now, when structure and function get fully integrated in our whole being through the disappearance of this isolated self-consciousness, then you will be in the state of enlightenment, in the state of peace, in the state of being a true human. That is the meaning of the true human, the perfected holy one, and nothing less than that. Again, don't make pictures of the perfected holy one, because how can I make a picture of the perfected holy one? Can't make a picture of it. The picture isn't a living reality in any case. This is Firoz, not that. That picture over there. It's a re-presentation. But that re-presentation is a structure which will make an impression upon you as you see it, and you will recognize the living person of which that is a representation. You see how difficult it is really to get the feel of life, to get the feel of this which is infinite, which is transcendent, which is the totality, which is reality. We are imprisoned in the structure. That is why those older teachers and philosophers, they said that the soul was imprisoned in the body, and the soul was always striving to get free of its prison house. You shuffle off this mortal coil. But remember, no body, no soul. Body, soul, body, mind are one reality, the psychophysical organism. And it doesn't end there. This is isolated self-consciousness, which has bedeviled the religious philosophies of the world. Spirit is this, soul is that, body is that. All beautifully parceled out. So many words. Oh, they even got sanctified on it. The people who produced the basic theologies of the great religions, they are saints so-and-so and all the rest of it. God laughs quietly at the saintly activities on the planet. See, this religious living is just daily living, actually, but free of isolated self-consciousness. So, when one gets free of just this psychophysical organism as oneself and as ending here, then one is sensitive to the fact that there is more than this, and the more ultimately includes the totality. Only the totality deserves the name I. And in that I, there is no you. Not in the terms of exclusiveness. The word I, the Sanskrit aham, the Latin ego, not our modern English use of the word ego, but the real Latin ego, is the one total reality. Eternal God, if you like to call it. So you see, the word I is really a very sacred word. The Sanskrit word aham really represents the one total reality which is present and which is undeniable when all the illusions concerned with it are gone. The I, that in that sense, in this total sense of the ultimate reality, is the unabandonable. You can't abandon it, how can you? As whilst one is alive, try and abandon your body. Can you? You can't. So, in consciousness, in awareness, this is where the mind comes in. It is the great link between the absolute transcendent and all this that we see. So when in consciousness you have realized the unabandonability of the totality, then there is no isolative self-consciousness. There is no poisonous root of self. The root, shall we say, of a tree of evil, so to say, to spoil life and to poison life. And one of the consequences of all that, apart from being free of grasping and possessing and so forth, one will cease from innumerable useless activities we carry out throughout the day. You watch these activities of human beings. If one is frightened of looking at oneself, and sometimes oneself is better not looked at, it's a terrifying sight. Look at the activities of others. What are they born of? Vanity, egoism, pride, conceit, illusion, downright stupidity, restlessness, incapacity, ignorance, folly. My goodness, that was a sentence. But isn't that true? Now, if we really understand this, if we really see this, free of isolative self-consciousness, then we will see it compassionately and wisely. Otherwise, we will see it critically, condemning the other, or oneself, as the case may be. Or when we look at what we commonly call the good qualities, we'll see it with approval, with appreciation, and we will immediately grasp that and be attached to it, which is also a bondage. The whole thing is the stream of life which flows on. Let it. Don't obstruct the stream of life. Life is sweet, is wonderful, is pure. And it really is good to be alive, provided one is alive. Most of us human beings wear ourselves out, kill ourselves, trying to live. But there's no need for that. In the quiet and in peace, you will be happy.